Welcome, everybody, to the April 6, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. I apologize for the delay. Other parties having a bit of a temper tantrum today, so we'll try to do some things that we can do. I want to make sure that people who have come a long way to testify, we can do that. Around 2:30, we may have to recess slightly to go back on the floor, but we'll work until we get there. So we're going to start off with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 921. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 921 directs the Department of Transportation to make efforts by 2021 to complete installation of median barriers between opposing lanes of travel on interstate highways when the distance between the lanes is 100 feet or less, except that the segments of interstate highway are designated for emergency access or if the median barriers may create a safety or operational hazard to the public. Names new provision, the Fritz Fairchild Act. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact.
Commissioner Fritz and Mr. Mathers. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT here to speak on Senate Bill 921. ODOT supports Senate Bill 921. After tragic crashes last fall in Salem and Albany, we have taken two significant steps. The first was using emergency contracting to accelerate a project we had planned for this summer to construct a cable barrier in the Salem area and in the southern Willamette Valley. I'm sure if you've traveled these areas, you've seen the construction going on. In fact, our schedule shows next week we'll have those projects complete. The other step we took was to review our policy. Our former policy was to close medians that were 60 feet or less in width, and we've changed that policy to now closing medians that are 100 feet or less. This means about 100 additional miles of median on the interstate will need to be closed, and we plan on doing this as funding allows. We have many safety needs on the system. We have many proactive steps that we can take to help prevent crash. Cable barriers is just one of those. Rumble strips, curve warning signs, and others are proactive steps that we've put into our program. We also have expectations to address high crash locations and be reactive to those areas that show a history of crashes. Both these things are limited by funding. As you know, you've heard me talk and others from the department talk about our need for transportation funding, and safety is no different than talking about bridge or pavements or other transportation needs. However, we believe we can meet the expectations in Senate Bill 921 by the specified date of 2021.
Good. Thank you, Paul. Commissioner.
Good afternoon. I'm Amanda Fritz, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Riley, for taking my testimony. I'm Mrs. Stephen Fritz, and 192 days ago, my husband was killed on his way to work along with his passenger, our good friend, Carrie Fairchild. He was going to the state hospital as he'd worked there for 24 years providing services to the citizens of Portland, and Carrie was a therapist there, and they were dedicated to helping the people of Oregon in the state hospital. And had this crash barrier been up at that point, they would be here today. And so I'm here to ask you to please adopt the policy, and then hopefully we can find some funding, because the last thing I want is for this new policy to take away funding from another safety project that's desperately needed. There are so many things that need to be funded throughout our state, and I serve on the Portland City Council, and we've had our own highly publicized discussions about about transportation funding, so I'm certainly aware that there's a lot of needs out there for both maintenance and transportation safety projects, and I appreciate everything that you and your colleagues in this legislature are doing to address all of those needs. This policy is a start, and it will hopefully, working with the Department of Transportation, to get these barriers up wherever they're needed throughout Oregon. It's really unfortunate that your Republican colleagues are not here, because most of the districts where they're still needed are in rural, central, and southern Oregon. So this is something that we should all be coming together on to set the policy and make sure that we find ways to do it in a responsible way. So thank you very much for your meeting with me ahead of time, Mr. Chair, and also for your taking this testimony.
I think they will be supportive when the bill gets to the floor, and I do think that we've made, or ODOT has made, some significant progress in the last few months, or at least I've noticed that as I commute up and down I-5. Soon, I would guess by summer, you're going to have from Eugene all the way to Portland pretty well cabled, aren't you?
Mr. Chair, actually, our plans are showing by next week we'll have that project complete, and that will complete the I-5 section north of, from Cottage Grove north, actually a little south of that, but from that general area of Highway 38 junction on north will be complete. But we have further work to do further south on I-5 and then on I-84 as well.
Great. Thank you. Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just want to thank Councilor Fritz for being here. It is important that we do this business, and I think that the department is acting very responsibly in responding to these kinds of issues. And I do believe that our Republican colleagues will be supportive of this as well when they're here. So I think that this is a good measure. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And if I might just add that often Portland is berated as the 800-pound gorilla that doesn't care about the rest of the state. And if I can do my part to show that, in fact, yes, we do. We in Portland do care about the whole state. And this is an active measure that I'm looking forward to seeing them up throughout Oregon. Thank you very much to the department for it. They've been great partners.
Thank you. Commissioner. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you, Chairman Beyer, Senator Riley. For the record, I'm Roger Nyquist, Chair of the Linn County Board of Commissioners. I also, for the last 15 years, have been a member of the Cascades West Area Commission on Transportation. So I have some experience and understanding of how funding for transportation projects flow, or in some cases, how it doesn't flow. I'm here to support Senate Bill 921. This bill will save lives. It represents a great value to the taxpayers. As I understand it, the cable barriers from Salem to the Eugene area is about a $6 million project, and this is good as it gets for the taxpayers of Oregon and for the citizens in the way of value for their tax dollars in creating a transportation system that's as safe as we can get it for the money that we spend. I would ask that you consider amending the bill, and to be clear, I don't want to confuse things, and if this thing is set to go the way it is, I respect that. In Linn County, we have a problem on Highway 34 between Corvallis and Lebanon. In the last 100 days, we've had two double fatals, and in both cases, young men crossed the center line and hit oncoming traffic, and the results were terrible. And in both cases, there were young children in a vehicle who somehow survived this accident. I do believe that the agency that ODOT is scheduled in the next couple years to place rumble strips
right
on both sides. I would submit to you that with the time it takes to do transportation projects, and as our traffic and problem continue to increase on Highway 34, that's not enough, that they should save their money and begin more solid solution, if you will, whether that be guardrails or jersey barriers or whatever the traffic engineers conclude. But the problem is just going to get worse. I would compare it somewhat, I guess, to Beltline and Eugene in areas that you don't allow traffic to cross over. Or it's someday will be the equivalent of I-84 between Portland and the airport. Can you imagine that system without something to keep those crossover accidents? I can't help but comment on the funding or the lack of funding that's available, and I agree that it's tight, but the agency and everybody involved in transportation planning and funding in the state needs to make safety a priority. We seem to get a lot more for our buck than doing other things. And just an example, again, I don't want to sidetrack the conversation, but I'd ask you to look at Connect Oregon and what you're doing for those dollars and what you could be doing for the taxpayers if you just took a session off from Connect Oregon and you bonded ODOT's ARTS program, which is safety projects, prioritizing stuff, and you just... You're getting a lot for the dollars spent, and would encourage that the agency makes safety across the board the top priority.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having had a son at Oregon State, I've driven that highway a few times, and it is a dangerous highway. I've noticed people speed there a lot, and so I applaud you, talking to us about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And let's see, Eva.
Thank you, Chair.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 921. My name is Eva Ripito, and I am political coordinator with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. As you may know, Dr. Fritz was president of AFSCME Local 3327. Dr. Fritz was a great local president and cared deeply for his colleagues. He would be thrilled to know that with completed barriers, they will be safer in their commutes to fulfill their mission of their work at Oregon State Hospital. Both Dr. Fritz and Ms. Fairchild were greatly admired by their coworkers at the state hospital, and I know that they are missed. Completing the barriers and having barriers in other parts of the states may help prevent others from losing their loved ones too early. Please support Senate Bill 921.
Thank you. Any questions? Great. Is there anybody else who would wish to comment on Senate Bill 921? I would, for the record, note that President Courtney had signed up and expressed that he is in very strong support of this bill. He's a little bit tied up at the moment. So we will recess on Senate Bill 921. Which one next?
This one, yeah. House Bill 223.
Well, we don't need any House bills yet. Who else here? Who's... Well, I guess that's the one I had somebody here. Okay, so we'll open public hearing on House Bill 2389.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Committee, House Bill 2389 changes process by which an individual may receive recognition with a fallen hero road sign memorial sign, declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Michael Thorpe.
Thank you, Senator Beyer and Senator Riley, for listening to my testimony. My name is Michael Thorpe from Tangent, Oregon. Just to give a little bit of history about the sign deal, and in Memorial Day 2012, I got to have the honor of being in Massachusetts to spend Memorial Day with a family of a friend of my son's who was killed in Iraq in October of 2005. And he was a good friend of my son's, and my son was killed in Iraq in November of 2005. And his brother and I, we got to be in Massachusetts and spend Memorial Day with his family and pay our respects to him in person. While we were there, we got to see a bridge that was named in his honor, his Lance Corporal Shane Cabino. Of Canton, Massachusetts. This is a $20 million bridge that was being started when he deployed, and we got to go and visit and stand in front of the sign naming this bridge in his honor. And it was just when I got back and actually printed the picture and looked at it, it was just real. It's like, why can't we do that in the state of Oregon? You know, do things like that. And so I had noticed for years seeing the roadside signs for fallen police officers. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to do something, you know, kind of like that. So that was my motivation. So Dave Troyer and myself got together in October of 2012 with Representative Wilson, and House Bill 2708 was formed, where we had three roadside signs that were going to be put along Highway 34 for Eric McKinley and Kevin Davis, and all of, you know, from Lebanon and Albany and Corvallis areas. So, but to do that, it was quite complex, because you actually had to write a bill up with the location where the sign is, and then ODOT had to amend their rules and everything else to do that. So from the session, when the session started in 2013, it went through, was great and everything else. And when the governor signed it in May of that year, we had to wait until January before it would take effect. And that's where the changes that are going to be made in this particular bill would separate ODOT from the legislature, where you can have a House concurrent resolution or a Senate concurrent resolution, and simply recognizing the sacrifice of the named person, and then there's an emergency declared, and once the governor signs it, it becomes effective immediately. That's going to be so much easier for the families, because the other families that have contacted me and asked, you know, well, what do I need to go get this done? And when you lay out how long it took, you know, everybody's in their own grieving process in a different way. And some of them are not ready to, you know, spend that much time and effort to try to do something like that. So this really speeds everything up for everyone. And so many families, there's right now, I believe there are seven signs between the Senate and House in concurrent resolutions waiting to be approved. Mm-hmm. And they're all overjoyed that when that happens and the governor signs those, that they'll be able to go work with ODOT immediately. And those signs can be placed this year. And so you can take like 90 days to have this process completed versus over a year. And so the roadside signs are good for healing. I know when I pass my sons each time, it's... it makes me really proud of that sacrifice. And it gets the names off the headstones and on the highways, where people can read them and learn about what these people gave. But I thank you for... thank you, sir. I thank you in advance for considering making these changes. And I know there's a lot of other families out there that are going to be real thankful, too, that they can get these done for their loved ones. So, Chairman and Senator Riley, I thank you very much for listening to my testimony.
I appreciate you bringing this to us. Thank you. Any questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this bill? Welcome.
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, I'm Abby Weekly from Representative Olson's office. He would be here today, but he was unable to make it. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I just wanted to provide some background information. In 2011, the legislature passed House Bill 3039, which created the Roadside Memorial Program for fallen law enforcement officers. Since 2011, the legislature has passed 14 concurrent resolutions allowing families to install a highway memorial sign in honor of those killed in the line of duty. So House Bill 2389 mirrors House Bill 3039 in that it creates a roadside memorial program for fallen soldiers. This is a really simple program, creating an easy pathway for families to request a highway memorial sign, as Mr. Thorpe just noted. So if you have yet to see any of the signs installed, there's some pictures uploaded on OLIS for your viewing. It's a small way to honor those who sacrificed their lives for serving our country, and I ask that you move forward with this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Member of the Committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I'm really here to answer questions, but this is just a process improvement bill that mirrors the Fallen Hero or the Fallen Officer Program. The Fallen Hero Program would mirror the Fallen Officer Program and would improve the process greatly, as you heard.
Okay. Thank you. No question. Thank you very much. Anybody else? Well, we will recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 921, and let's see, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 922. James.
Mr. Chair, committee, Senate Bill 922 provides that reimbursement to member of legal expense organization for charges that member incurs for legal services does not include nominal fee for operating expenses that legal expense organization incurs or pays to provide attorney. Specifies allowable operating expenses, including expenses that the legal expense organization incurs in referring members to the providing attorney, expenses the providing attorney incurs in processing contact information for members, but does not include any amount that the providing attorney charges for legal services. We do have a dash one amendment. It replaces the entire measure to further clarify the intent of the bill that a legal access plan is not a legal expense plan and thus not subject to the insurance code. There is no impact statements for the dash one amendment.
Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Riley, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of LegalZoom, which is a legal access provider providing services through Oregon attorneys for individuals and small businesses. Those services range from simple wills, power of attorneys, leases, formation of LLCs are some of the examples. But under current law, Oregon's insurance statute requires companies to provide specific legal services or reimbursement for legal expenses to become licensed and regulated by the insurance division under DCBS. These are, in the dash one amendments, called legal expense plans. And so on page two of the dash one amendment on lines eight, we keep the language, and our intent is to keep legal expense plan the way it is, even though the draft legislative council did reword it, it's still the same intent because it does involve risk. For example, on a legal expense plan, you could have a policy that includes DOI defense coverage, for example. You pay a certain amount per month of premium, and you'd be able to reimburse an attorney to defend in a criminal case, perhaps without limits or perhaps up to a certain amount of hours. And so this specific example, for instance, is why this initial language was put into statute. If there is there's obviously risk for a loss there, and we would receive benefits far in excess of what they paid in premium. What we're trying to do in the bill, because LegalZoom does not provide legal services. Again, they're an access plan, so we're trying to differentiate between a legal expense plan and a legal access provider in the bill. And so when LegalZoom approached the insurance division in the interim, we were one of the few states where there was a gray area, and they felt like they needed legislative action to kind of clear this up. Again, they do not provide legal services or reimburse for legal expenses, but could be subject under the insurance code, in which case they'd have to be a licensed insurance company when they're not. One of the examples, so the plan members benefit with access to attorneys at a reasonable cost for limited scopes of work. The attorneys benefit from the referrals of the clients in need of assistance. And the main thing that we differentiate between the legal expense plan and a legal access plan is that the attorneys often just receive a small monthly administrative fee for the enrolled customers to cover the costs relating to opening files and handling administrative matters. And so in the dash one amendments, we essentially define administrative fee and what is a nominal fee that would be paid for an attorney that is being referred this kind of work. And we are going to need a dash two, and I did forward that to James just right before the hearing, just because in lines nine, we talked about what this a nominal administrative fee would be. And we have $12 per month or an amount DCBS specifies by rule. And that's kind of awkward to have an amount or DCBS by rule. And so we have something even simpler, I think, where we start out at $6 per month or an amount greater. So give the ability for DCBS to authorize something larger from that if they need to. And so that's basically the substance of what we need in a dash two. And I tried to get that in time for the hearing, but was unable to. And you know, again, this just clears up a LegalZoom operates in most states. There's only just a few states where they found where the insurance statutes may cover them. This is one of the states where they have that gray area, and this would resolve that issue. And again, they're using Oregon attorneys, so they're referring to attorneys practicing in Oregon. And the legal relationship on between the client and the attorney is again between that member and that attorney. So happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Riley?
Thank you. So explain to me how this is different. This is something that you pay dues to, mm-hmm. and they refer you to a lawyer. How is this different from something where you pay fees and they refer you to a doctor?
Good question, Mr. Chair, Senator Riley.
Okay. Because they're going to have a call over the Senate.
I guess I need just clarity on your question. What's the difference between that?
Yeah.
I think in this case, you're you know, a lot of the personal plans are $9.99 a month. And some of the small business plans are about $23.99 a month, and so you're getting access to very, you're getting access to things that you may need for small business work. If there's anything outside of that, I think the attorneys benefit because they get the referrals for any other work, and so. But again, I think you're getting, creations of LLCs. There's a lot of simple forms that you can use for individuals or businesses that you have access to for that low price. And so it's an affordable service that many people use, small businesses use, for an affordable price without having to maybe to go directly to an attorney and pay an hourly rate.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's two parts to this. One part is where you're paying for a service where they provide forms, which, mm-hmm. you know, that's pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
The other part is you're paying a, what is it, a monthly fee? Or I don't know how that works, but if it's a monthly fee where if you need a lawyer, you refer them to a lawyer.
Well, you're referred to a lawyer regardless. So a practicing attorney that the LegalZoom will have relationships in the states are doing the work for the customer. So even all the work that you would need under these plans, you're going to get from that attorney,
right,
and that relationship is with that attorney.
So including a form.
Yeah.
Yes, form.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Because we're not practicing law, so the LegalZoom is not saying we're actually a network providing that access to lawyers at a low price, and then they pay an administrative cost to be able to handle the files and do things.
Yeah, a lot like an insurance company.
Yes. Yeah. Well, similar, but not because there's no risk. There's not a risk to the to LegalZoom because they're not indemnifying or, again, when we had that conversation with the insurance division, being able to clarify the difference between the two and why a legal expense plan is different than what they're doing.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with that, but I hear what you're saying.
We have some time to talk about that.
Yeah.
We'll wait until the amendments come back.
Yeah.
Is there anybody else who wishes to address the committee on this bill? If not, thank you, Sean.
Thanks.
We will close the public hearing on that one and wait for the amendments.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we now have a quorum. So the chair will open a work session on House Bill 2389. Chair moves House Bill 2389 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? House Bill 2389 is moved to the House to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll close on that one. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 921.
Yeah, carrier real quick.
Carrier Whose bill was it?
Representative Olson.
Yeah. So I'm familiar with
representative
this.
Representative or senator? Representative?
Both. You want they were both on it.
Oh, they were both on it?
Yeah.
We'll ask Senator Olson if he wants to carry it. We're open on Senate Bill 921. Chair moves Senate Bill 921 to the Senate floor with a DuPas recommendation. Discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition? There is none. Senate Bill 921 moves to the Senate floor with a DuPas recommendation.
You want me to carry that one?
You can carry it.
Okay.
Senator Monroe carries. We'll close on that one. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 117.
We do have a dash one.
And we have a dash one amendment on that. James?
The dash one amendment allows task force to explore jurisdictional transfers to occur from city or county to state as well as from state to city or county. And there is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact on that statement.
Okay, and you want to just go ahead and say what the main bill does, too?
Yes, the main bill creates task force on jurisdictional transfers, sunsets task force on December 31st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Chair moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 117. Discussion? Is there any opposition? Dash ones are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 117 as amended by the dash ones to the Senate floor with a DuPas recommendation with the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? There is none. Let's move to the Ways and Means with the DuPas recommendation. All right, now we're back on. They haven't called us back yet, so we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 675. You don't need to hang for this if you don't want.
Yeah, I better get down there. I'm closing the bill.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you'll be called in a minute.
As soon as we're called. Go ahead, James.
Yes. Senate Bill 675 eliminates requirement that bidder or proposer for public contract demonstrate responsibilities by submitting signed affidavit that attests that bidder or proposer complied with tax laws of the state, becomes operative 91 days after effective date, declares emergency effective on passage. There is a dash 2 amendment. They eliminate signed affidavit requirement for bidder or proposer for public contract to a local contracting agency, but still requires bidder and proposer to attest to being up to date on state taxes. There's a minimal revenue impact, and we are still awaiting the fiscal statement.
Okay, I think I got three of you, Diane Lancaster, Brian Smith, and Chris Frank.
Zach says
Zach says
he needs you at the floor.
On the floor?
That's what Zach says.
Well, they haven't come and got us yet.
Okay.
We may get interrupted here, so I'll warn you that. We may have a call going on.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Beyer, Senator Riley. My name is Brian Smith, and I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 675. So by way of context, ORS 279B110 lays out for public agencies those things that the public agencies have to review to determine that a vendor is responsible as part of our evaluation of their bid or proposal. So if they're not determined responsible, we cannot contract with them. So public agencies routinely use a representations and certifications form, which in addition to making their bid or proposal a binding legal one, includes the assurances that a public agency needs to help them determine that a vendor is responsible. Last year's House Bill 4122 created, among other things, a new requirement for vendors to be determined responsible by public agencies. And specifically, vendors must have complied with the tax laws of the state or political subdivision of the state. As both a public official and a taxpayer, I believe this is a reasonable and important consideration when spending our tax dollars, and I fully support it. However, this new responsibility criterion also came with a new requirement for vendors. They need to submit an affidavit to demonstrate their compliance. This is the only responsibility requirement that requires an affidavit. The affidavit requires notarization, whereas a representation and certification form only needs to be signed. This tripped up a lot of public agencies in the implementation of this requirement over the last year, and has made the landscape of bidding and proposing for public work more complex for vendors, as they now have different forms with different certification requirements. Senate Bill 675 retains the responsibility requirements that the vendors must have paid their taxes and treats it the same as all the other responsibility requirements. I hear all the time from vendors that it's difficult to work with public agencies, and as a public purchasing professional, I'm constantly challenging
the processes we set up as an agency to ensure we make it as easy and efficient as possible while remaining legally compliant. I believe the provision for an affidavit brings additional complexity to both vendors and public agencies without any significant public benefit, and I urge you to move it forward. Senate Bill 675 would make it easier for vendors to do business with public agencies. It would make it legal compliance more efficient for public agencies, and that's a better value for taxpayers. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
So in essence, we screwed up last time. We shouldn't have required the affidavit. If they just, we get to the same ends by just requiring that they, what did you call it? There's certificate.
Certification.
Yeah. The,
okay. Yeah. So just a little administrative change to get to the same ends and make it easier.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
Go ahead.
I'm Chris Fick with Multnomah County's Office of Government Relations. The only context I want to add is that this bill does have the support of the Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities. And we also touched base with Representatives Holvey and Nathanson, who originally crafted the bill from last session to receive their consent on these amendments.
He's all right? Okay. Diane, I bet the state's okay with this.
Chairman Beyer, representatives of the committee, for the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administrative Services. We would heartily support the Dash 2 concept. The single word affidavit turned out to be a legal word which requires a sworn statement, and the only way that agencies can comply is by having those statements be in a notarized format and submitted by every bidder or proposer. The dollar level starts at $10,000, and it covers all goods and services under 279B, which is ordinary trade goods and services. You can imagine the burden on the smaller businesses who now must submit an affidavit every time they go through this. We did find out that a lot of the small agencies are struggling with it as well. They just don't have the procurement shops to truly understand and receive these, and it has been something of a hassle. I will say, however, that Secretary of State has been very helpful, and it turns out that notaries can put in at Secretary of State to be recognized as providing electronic notarization. So we certainly learned something, and that increase of electronic use has been helpful. Nonetheless, we're very supportive of a word change.
I've always thought that notary republics were an anachronism of the past. I'm not sure why we still have them. Okay. Any other questions? We do not have the paperwork today, so we can't move it. I should ask, is there anybody else who wishes to address the committee on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on that, and I think that takes us to the end. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing none, we adjourn for the day. Not a bad day. Okay. Not a bad day. Okay. Committee, seeing none, we adjourn for the day.